Hello, welcome to the Fantastic Fiction at KGB reading series. Fantastic Fiction is a monthly speculative fiction reading series held on the third Wednesday of every month, hosted by Ellen Datlow and me, Matthew Kressel. We spotlight well-known and up-and-coming science fiction, fantasy, and horror authors, and admission is always free. We publish a monthly podcast and video so people who can't attend the in-person event can still enjoy the readings. If you'd like to support the series, you can donate at kgbfantasticfiction.org/support. Anyway, on to the show.
All right. We're going to get started. Welcome, everyone, to Fantastic Fiction at KGB. How's everyone doing tonight? All right. My name is Matt Kressel, and I co-host this series with Ellen Datlow. Our series is on the second Wednesday of every month. It is always free. There's never a cover charge. All we ask is that you buy a drink, hard or soft, and tip your bartender, Mary, who's working hard to keep you hydrated. Let's give a applause to Mary. Thank you, Mary. Of course. So I'm very excited for our guest tonight. As you may know, Christopher Rowe had a death in the family, so he couldn't make it tonight. So Richard Butner was awesome and stepped in for Christopher at the last minute. So thank you to Richard. And we also have Moses Osiutomi reading. So I'm a fan of both of their works for a long time, and really happy to have them. We have a mailing list on our website. If you go to kgbfantasticfiction.org, click on the newsletter or mailing list. I forget exactly what the link, where the link is on the site, but you'll see it. It's right there. You can sign up. We don't spam. We send like two or three emails a month reminding you about the series. Also, you could follow myself or Ellen on all the socials where we post about the series. And I don't know. Do we have any other announcements? I'm gonna just read off the list of the upcoming readers.
I was gonna do that.
You wanna do that? I'll let Ellen do it. I won't steal her thunder.
Are there any books for sale? No.
Yes. Which I will mention. Our first reader is Moses Osiutomi. Moses is a Nigerian American fantasy writer and nomad, currently based out of San Diego, California. He has an MFA in fiction from Sarah Lawrence College and short fiction publications in fantasy magazines, Sunday Morning Transport, and other venues. He is the author of the young adult fantasy novel Daughters of Oduma and the Forever Desert, the fantasy novella series that includes the acclaimed The Lies of the Ajungo. When he's not writing, he's traveling, training martial arts, or doing karaoke with or without a backing track. So, Moses, what books do we have for sale today? Let's just let people know what we have here.
I have both books in the Forever Desert trilogy, or the two that are out already, The Lies of the Ajungo and The Truth of the Other Kid.
Okay, I'll hold them up so we can see them in the light. There we go. I love these covers, by the way. I just want to say, I don't know who the artist is, but they're really amazing. The Lies of the Ajungo and Truth of the Eleke. So, at the break, come up. Buy a book, get them signed, and do you have books for sale as well?
I do not have books
for sale. You do not have books for sale, but you could also buy Richard's books online, right? So here we go. So here's Moses. Thank you.
Yes. You can applause. It's okay.
Hello. How's everyone doing? Good. Thank you, Matt and Ellen, for hosting this series, and thank you for inviting me tonight. Richard, thank you for filling in. Appreciate you stepping up. This is exciting. I've only ever been to this as a fan, so it's wild to be on the other side of it. I'm very excited to read for you all. So, The Truth of the Eleke is a sequel, right? Lies of the Ajungo came out first. If you haven't read it, I'm going to catch you up so it won't be too confusing without spoiling anything. These are very slim books. If I say too much, I will spoil everything, so I'll be very careful. The Lies of the Ajungo, it's a North African-inspired fantasy. It takes place in a world where there has been droughts for hundreds of years. And so a long time ago, the king went to this other empire and said, I would like some water. We need water. You guys have water. What can we work out? And they said, give us the tongues of all your citizens. And so they had to cut out the tongues of everyone 13 years or older, ship it across the continent in exchange for what they hoped would be enough water to change their civilization, what turned out to be just a fraction of water, because the Ajungo are scumbags. And they made it so that it became a ritual. So that every time anyone turned 13, they had to cut out the tongue, ship it across the continent in exchange for a fraction of water. And the first book follows a boy named Tutu, whose mother passed out from dehydration. He decides to venture into this endless desert in search of water, not just for her, but for the entire city. Right? And the second book picks up 500 years after that first book. So we're in new characters, new conflict, same place. So now we get to take a look at how those events have become history and perhaps mythology, and things start to change. So I'm going to hop around a little bit to avoid big spoilers, but we'll start from the beginning. The Aleke is cruel. This first truth was learned in the days of the great Mamas, just as the wellspring returned water to the world after the fall of the evil Chief Tutu. The most powerful seer the goddess had ever chosen, Chief Tutu and his armies conquered the free cities of the Forever Desert, constructing a road from the bones of their enemies that coursed halfway around the known world. The great Ijefi, Oba of the last free city, watched Chief Tutu's army emerge from the desert to surround her city's walls. Ijefi was a poet, an astronomer, a woman of culture. When Chief Tutu demanded she swear fealty, she refused. "I am already sworn to peace," her final words. Chief Tutu's armies took the city within a day. Chief Tutu himself beheaded Oba Ijefi within her palace, then rolled her head down the steps. He sacked the city, then declared it to have a new name, one that mocked their pledge of peace against the inevitability of war, the City of Lies. Yet this is only where the story begins. Intoxicated by victory and seated proudly in his new throne room, Chief Tutu's end soon came at the hands of a single soldier, a low-ranked spearman who had lost his unit in the fighting. Captured and tortured, but refusing to be broken, the soldier freed himself, wrenched a spear from a guard, and hurled it at Chief Tutu, impaling him to his throne. Centuries passed. As Chief Tutu's empire crumbled to infighting, life flourished along the central river valley, and travelers from across the Forever Desert sought out the city, inspired by the memory of the spearmen. It was then that the Aleke emerged. Armored in night, a terror born from the depths of the rolling desert, he was inspired not by the valiant memory of the spearmen, but by the atrocities of Chief Tutu. His followers, the cult of Tutu, soon swelled into an army. The new cities of the Forever Desert closed their gates, sentencing the upstart conqueror to death by desert heat. But the Aleke is clever. The second truth was learned when the city's gates were opened from within by agents of the Aleke. His cult flooded forth, sacking city after city and cutting out the tongues of all conquered peoples so that they would forever remember the folly of revolt and forever beseech the mercy of subjugation. From then, the Aleke's cult of Tutu grew, crushing each subsequent city with greater ease and more monstrous violence. Soon, there was once again but a single free city standing against an evil overlord of the Forever Desert. But rather than a peaceful city of lies, what the Aleke encountered was a city that was armed and battle-ready, a city that remembered the fate of its peaceful predecessors and clung instead to the ferocious resistance of the spearmen, a city of truth. For 3 centuries, the war between the Aleke and the City of Truth has raged. The city's walls have been destroyed, thousands of its warriors killed, its way of life endangered. Only the city's elite warriors, the truth seekers, have kept the city from suffering the fate that so many have suffered. But the Aleke is cruel, and the Aleke is clever, and all the city citizens of the City of Truth know the day is approaching when the Aleke will bring the full might of the cult of Tutu crashing down upon their city, a final battle to end the unending war. The Aleke is coming, and only Osi can stop him. Osi always dreaded returning home. Out in the city, he was Junior Peacekeeper Osi, the pride of his community. In his pale blue robes, bronze half-helm, and sturdy sandals, he was the very image of the spearman. His duty to keep the city's peace was a sacred one. At home, he was just Osi, washer of cutlery, sweeper of floors. And today, he was even less than that. "Eh, look at him," his mama said, surveying his busted lip and swollen right hand. "The fighter." News of O.C.'s day had flown ahead of him. "Hello, Mama," he said sheepishly, standing in the doorway, his eyes held fast to the floor. His family was seated on the ground around a large circular dining cloth. There were two open spaces to sit, one of which was left empty in his Baba's memory. O.C. went to the other spot, between his two older and younger sisters, then sat with care on his tender backside. "Does it hurt?" the youngest sister whispered. He shook his head. His commander had given him 10 lashes for insubordination, whipping him across his butt right in the middle of the Central District's most active roundabout. Pain was bearable, as was humiliation. The real punishment was far worse. "So, no ascendance for this one?" his mama said sharply. O.C. could feel her eyes on him. "In the entire history of this city, you are the first ever to be disinvited. What an honor for this family. Congratulations, O.C." The ascendance was the biggest ceremony in the City of Truth. It was only held when it was time to induct a new class of truth seekers, and it had been 6 years since the last one. The next was likely a decade away. A once-in-a-generation event that O.C.'s commitment to the peacekeepers had earned him an invitation to, despite his records of misdeeds, and he'd ruined it. "What happened this time, eh?" his mama spat. He took a deep breath. "Mama, they were thieves. I watched them steal from the Yenwele bakery with my own eyes, so I chased them." "You chased them so much you broke your hand and face?" she asked. Beside him, his eldest sister mumbled under her breath, "Do not explain, just apologize." His sister was wise, far wiser than O.C. An apology would lead to dinner, warm food in his belly, a peaceful night's rest, and sanctuary from his mama's ire. But O.C. didn't care about any of those things. The world was a place of good and evil, right and wrong. Punishing thieves for stealing from innocent citizens was right. If it was against the rules for a junior peacekeeper to arrest bad people, then it was the rules that needed to change, not him. "Do not fear that you may do wrong, his Baba had taught him from a young age. "Fear that you may not do right." O.C. raised his face, his eyes meeting his mama's. "I chased them and taught them never to steal again." "Why is he this way?" his eldest sister sighed. An argument ensued. O.C. and his mama shared a temper, the sort that simmered before inevitably boiling over. All their fights transcended the moment, dredging up unforgiven trespasses from years before, burdened by a refusal to accept the other's imperfections. To his mama, O.C. bore the same impetuous foolishness that had gotten her husband killed. To O.C., his mama was too fearful and weak to imagine a better world. Neither was incorrect. "Again and again," his mama shouted, "they have been patient with you, and this is how you behave. Disinvited from the ascendants. Imagine, you are lucky he did not dismiss you entirely, you God's blind child." "Dismiss for what?" O.C. shot back, earning groans from his sisters. "They were thieves. If I see bad people in our city, I will fight them and fight them and fight them. If you do not like it, I do not care." He was crying. He always cried when he got angry, and he always got angry when he argued with his mama. Crying, chest heaving, every muscle in his body was clenched with the rage and fear and frustration of not being understood. "And now he cries," said one of his sisters. "Mama, may we be excused?" another asked. His mama's rage seemed to evaporate. She beheld her son with only pity, like she was looking upon a sheep wandering the desert alone, unaware of the hunters on its trail. "You think you're always right, we'll see," she said in a calm voice. "One day you will learn you are a fool like everyone else and that you should have listened to your betters. But until that day," she added, locking him in a lethal gaze, "you are not 6, you are 16. Act your age. If you bring another drop of shame on this family, I swear by the spearman himself that I will disown you. Do you hear?" O.C. wiped the tears from his face, but they kept coming. He wanted to rage through the house, breaking every dish and tearing down the walls, but he didn't want his little sisters to see him like that. So instead, he shot a final dark glance at his mama, turned, and stormed out the front door. In the days of the great mamas, it was said that the city was surrounded by massive walls, but the Aleke had spent centuries tearing them down with giant machines that hurled rocks the size of a house. Now there was no trace that the walls had ever existed. Instead, watchtowers had been raised throughout the city, allowing the peacekeepers to both monitor the city's happenings and to watch the horizon for the approach of the Aleke and his cult. When O.C. was a child, the Aleke's raids had come often. Sometimes the city burned, but most of the time, The peacekeepers, his Baba among them, would form up and march out to the city limits, facing the endless expanse of the forever desert. Led by the mighty truth seekers, they would intercept the Alakay's forces, turning them back. Baba had died in such a fight, slain in the desert by some unknown cultist. But his sacrifice had not been in vain. The city of truth still lived and was stronger than ever. The fear of the Alakay created a sense of unity, driving crime down, bolstering the ranks of the peacekeepers, and filling the city's tax coffers so as to rebuild the watchtowers at the city's farthest edges. Osi climbed the watchtower nearest his home, an old model that was now rarely staffed. At the top, he leaned against the wooden railing, taking deep breaths. To the west, the sky was slashed pink and orange as the sun lowered toward the Citadel of Truth on the horizon. Cascading tiers of brick homes and businesses slid toward the river in its green-lined valley. To the east, the forever desert was an expanse of barren, untamed sand. It mocked the city with its mirage of emptiness. Just beyond the horizon, in every direction, the Alakay and the cult of Tutu waited patiently with their sharpened teeth and blunt-cut tongues. Only a thin ring of desert separated the stable order of the city from the mad violence of the cult. It was the only defense the city had, besides the people of the city itself. People like Osi. He was doing his best, but some days he felt like he was the only one who really cared.
Osi.
He followed the sound of the voice at the base of the tower. Osi? Inusu called, peering up at him. She was his neighbor, an oldest friend. They'd gone through childhood side by side and had joined the junior peacekeepers on the same day. Unlike Osi, though, Inusu was smart and emotionally sober. She'd warned him not to pursue these, but he hadn't listened. Osi wiped the moisture from his cheeks and waved her up. She joined him, but remained silent for a while and joined the city overlook. You heard me and Mama fighting? He eventually asked. She nodded. You never close your windows. The whole neighborhood heard. Osi didn't care what his neighbors thought of him, but he didn't want them thinking less of his Mama, even if he was angry with her. Did you hear what she said? He asked. She would be wrong to disown you, yes, Inusu replied, but you were disinvited from the Ascendance, Osi. She didn't need to finish. The severity was clear, the greatest honor of his life taken away. What is wrong with me? He asked. Too much to say? Osi tried to laugh, but as soon as he opened his mouth, a sob came out, and the tears came again, and he buried his face in his hands. Inusu put a hand on his shoulder. There will be other Ascendances, she said unconvincingly. Of course there would be, but it didn't matter. This Ascendance was the only one he wanted to attend. These Ascendants, Izen, the wise, the Kende, the mighty, clever Hizokiye, and most of all, the legendary Luwen, were the ones he'd idolized since he was a boy, the finest Ascendant class in living memory. Osi had only seen them once before, the day they were introduced as Ascendants and paraded through the streets. That had been 10 years ago. Since then, they'd undergone the most arduous training in the world. He built himself up, too, following in his Baba's footsteps to join the peacekeepers. Osi'd always believed that if he could just see the Ascendants again and let them see him, that maybe they'd understand his desire to better the city in a way no one else could. He took a great inhale to still his shuddering chest. Crying was no use. Tomorrow, his peers would be enjoying the Ascendants, and he would be at the barracks, washing the laundry of every peacekeeper in the city. I just want to do what is right, he explained. Inusu nodded, but didn't speak. And long after she'd climbed back down the watchtower and gone to bed, Osi stayed out, watching over the darkened city, praying for the day he would finally learn from his mistakes. It was a prayer he would soon regret. I'm gonna hop ahead a little bit, avoid some spoilerific scenes. This isn't like the book description, so I can say it. So there's a big fight in the city. Osi steps up, partially because he's brave, partially because he's dumb, and he gets promoted for his efforts, essentially, to train with the True Seekers. Now he's on this, he's training for an exclusive mission to go into the Forever Desert and slay the Alakay and bring back the city's magic, which was stolen in the last attack. So I'm going to pick back up with Osi at the very beginning of his training to become an elite True Seeker soldier. The months passed impatiently, and soon the year was nearing its end. Oh wait, nope, sorry. Ignore that never happened. The first month was torture. Osi thought his body would grow accustomed to the training, but there was no time for recovery. Each day, the long and grueling exercises whittled him down. He gained a limp from the arduous daily runs, and the skin of his stump reopened from various exercises, forcing him to do even more things with one hand than usual. While the days sapped his body, the nights sapped his mind. Each night, the fall replayed itself in his nightmares. Over and over, he watched the Aleke and his cultists cut down his innocent citizens. Except sometimes the citizens were the truth seekers. Sometimes they were Inusu. Sometimes they were Mama and his sisters. And Osi would have to watch them die a dozen gruesome deaths before he'd wake in a violent sweat. But consistency makes progress an inevitability. With time and repetition, his muscles tightened, his mind endured, and he found himself feeling like a true ascendant. It didn't hurt that Lumen was his mentor. She was everything he'd imagined her to be, and more. An impetuous leader, a weapons genius, charisma personified. But she also possessed an intensity that Osi hadn't expected, a drive and purpose that left him watching with equal parts awe and terror as she pressed impossible weights overhead or hacked so violently at her training partners that she made splinters of their shields. Then she transformed from heaving chest and muscles engorged to smiling and sweet, all in an instant. 3 months into his year of training, Osi was finally ready to move beyond just watching the Truth Seeker spar. Osi, the Unfallen, Lumen called across the training grounds one afternoon, using the nickname that had arisen among the citizens. Train with Izen. Use sight. I do not know how, Osi admitted. At the fall, he'd used the power of the God's Eyes just from shock. But since then, he'd practiced on his own with inconsistent results. Lumen smiled. Ah, Izen, teacher. Sight is a function of knowledge and conviction, Izen explained. The scholar Lamizi was the first to articulate a comprehensive knowledge, Lumen cut in, is your bow. The more you have, the stronger you draw. Conviction is your arrow. Without it, you are harmless. Osi closed his eyes and thought of everything he knew, everything he learned from his parents and the peacekeepers, and his few months with the truth seekers, all the lessons he learned in the fall. On that knowledge, he rested the arrow of his conviction. Spearmen guide me, he prayed. When he opened his eyes, everything seemed to glow with life. He could see the roughness of the citadel's walls, see the smell of lunch on everyone's bed, see the heat of the clashing of bronze between Hizogiya and Lumen as they began sparring. His skin sparkled with tiny points of light, power given form as calmness and clarity settled into him. With enough conviction, all of the energy around him was his to wield. He just had to know and believe. He got thrashed anyway. Within minutes, he was exhausted and frustrated and lumped in a dozen places. He resolved to land just one firm strike, something to let him leave the sparring session with some of his dignity intact. He lunged forward, ignoring Izen's painful counterattack, and struck hard, much harder than he'd intended. For a moment, he could see his blunt training spear driving into Izen's abdomen, ramming into her ribs hard enough to bruise them. And suddenly, Osi found himself on the ground, his own ribs streaming, the muscles around them hot with damage. He rolled on the floor, clutching his torso and trying to blink the pain away. What happened? He squeezed out. Lumen squatted in front of him. You were fine, Osi, she said, sitting him up and rubbing his chest. See? All of Osi's thoughts disappeared. All he could think about was how close Lumen's face was, how good she smelled, how enveloping her eyes were, consuming him. He stared in silence. I did not injure you, Izen said, casually twirling her spear. That pain is your doing. The price of the seer, Lumen said. And with a final pat of his chest, she stood. He exhaled a life's worth of tension. Any pain you cause with your sight, you yourself will feel. But she's fine, Osi asked, nodding at Izen. Did she not feel it? I did, Izen said, but not like you. Lumen must have seen his confusion. A seer's senses are stronger, she explained. You can see, smell, and hear more than others, and feel. But as you learn to control it, that will change. Osi didn't understand, a position he was more frequently finding himself in. So, I cannot hit anyone, or I will suffer, he asked. How can I kill the Aleke if I cannot hurt him? You numb yourself, Hizogiya said. He was away from them, sitting with his head leaned back against the lunch table bench, staring at the sky. His voice lacked its usual bite. It was soft and calm, as sincere as Osi had ever heard it. A seer does not suffer when he steps on the sand, because he feels nothing for the sand. That is all people are, Osi, grains of sand. Burn them, crush them, step on them. You'll learn to feel nothing. Lumen gave Hisoki an impenetrable look, then she drew her practice weapon. Another round, she called out. Hizen, Hizo, together, I will help Osi. For the rest of the day, Hizokiye's words clung to Osi's thoughts. Of the three truth seekers, he was the one Osi knew least. In the past 3 months, they'd never had a single conversation. Even Izen, who spent most of her days in books, had asked Osi questions about his life, family, interests, experiences. But Hizokiye kept his distance. Hizokiye's words never left Osi's mind. They were the first truths Hizo had ever said to him.
I'll stop there.
Thank you. So you can buy some of the books, the one, two volumes, the first two volumes, yes. Come and buy them, he'll sign them for you. And we're gonna take a break for about 10 minutes and buy a drink, or, you know, either alcoholic or not, and enjoy everybody's company. Thank you. Hello, we're ready to go. Hello, everybody. Welcome. Hello, hey. Welcome back. Thank you.
Feels like it's very loud.
Welcome back to our monthly reading series. Matt gave you the information. If you want to get on our mailing list, just go to Fantastic Fiction at KGB and sign up. And we don't spam you. We promise. Okay. Upcoming readers are April 10th, Jennifer Marie Brissett and Robert Levy. May 8th, Anya Johanna De Niro and John Wiswell. June 12th, Bracken McLeod and Grady Hendrix. And in the farther future, we have Andrew Sayre, who's here now. And James Chambers, Sarah Beth Durst, and Sarah Langan over the next several months. So come back, please. And tonight we have, in place of Christopher Rowe, but is... It's fine. he's better than Chris. Chris will be back sometime, but you know. But Richard's a good guy and a good reader and a good writer. So anyway, Richard Butner's short fiction has appeared in the Year's Best Fantasy and Horror, been shortlisted for the Speculative Literature Foundation's Fountain Award, and nominated for the Shirley Jackson Award. His collection, The Adventurists, was published by Small Beer Press in March 2022. He lives in North Carolina, where he runs the annual Sycamore Hill Writers Conference. He and Harry Houdini have used the same trapdoor. I don't know what country he hasn't told you that. I'll have to tell you when he gets up here. Please welcome Richard Butner.
I might use my valuable minutes for telling you the trapdoor story. I went to a high school that was funded by tobacco money, by R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, perhaps you've heard of them. And Catherine Reynolds was very into education, and she built this fantastic high school in the early 1920s, and with a fantastic auditorium right next to it. And in, I believe, the early 20s, Harry Houdini performed there and did an escape, and there was one trapdoor in the stage, and it's still in that stage. And if you were a theater nerd, you know, working tech at that theater, then you went through the trapdoor too, right? Because you went through the same fucking trapdoor as Harry Houdini. So. All right, thank you. Am I too loud? Loud enough? Good. Okay, thank you. First of all, I have to say I'm here because I was here to see my good great friend Christopher Rowe read. He's a great guy and he's a great writer, and I would highly recommend that you go out both and buy Moses' books, that you buy my collection, The Adventurists from Small Beer Press, available wherever books are sold, and that you buy Christopher's latest book, The Navigating Fox. It's a really wonderful novella published by
Talking Animals.
I mean, who doesn't love Talking Animals? and like existential despair.
Tor.com.
It's a great book, and Christopher sends his regards. I talked to him today, and he's really he's really sad he can't be there, but here we are. So I'm going to read from a short story that is unpublished, hasn't even been sent out yet. I'm going to read the beginning of it, and a fantastic element might show up at some point. And this short story is called Fire Engine. The Friday before Labor Day, dust motes floating in the sunlight that penetrated the flimsy defenses of the ancient institutional blinds. Jeff waited for the usual pre-holiday email. It's a long weekend, everyone. Feel free to head out whenever you'd like. The minutes ticked by, and he lost himself in thoughts of where to take his new exploring friend this weekend. New-ish, Carlotta. She was 25, less than half his age, and had all that 20-something energy, a bonfire compared to the banked coals of 60-something. Other than that, she was pretty much perfect. Early, dependable, curious, good at risk analysis, up to date on tetanus vaccinations. At his age, he couldn't afford to explore solo anymore. But so many of the people he went out with turned out to be useless, not down with the anonymity of the program. Would-be influencers, bros who needed to prove something, people who used the word urbex. He and Carlotta had done several sites in the state already, the Art Deco water purification plant, the 1920s Gothic high school, the old plantation that was, technically speaking, on the grounds of an active army base, plus a road trip to an abandoned mental hospital up in Pennsylvania. So where to next? Maybe celebrate Labor Day with a trip to that silk mill on the river near Old Highway 10, closed since 1957, and yet somehow still not found by the vandals, the taggers. That was a good one, the room filled with a towering pile of spools of thread, the paint peeling off of the rusting control panels, gauges and switches and alarm bells all arrayed in decaying grids, the forest growing at one end of the factory floor where the roof had completely fallen in. And then an email did arrive, and it was 4:45 p.m., and the message was, "Jeff, please come see me in my office before you leave." 18 years at the library, and now this, one of these emails that you only get late on a Friday afternoon. He had been thinking about retirement. He'd run the numbers. He couldn't really afford it. When he got the email, that's when he decided he and Carlotta would go to the fire station that weekend. They'd go see the fire engine. "It's not about the quality of your work, Jeff," the administrator said. Her name was Angie. She'd been at Cole University less than 5 years. "It's just," she lifted her hands as if displaying an invisible banquet on her desk, "budget cuts, shifting priorities, and the pandemic didn't help." "It's okay," Jeff said, moving as little of his face as he could to get the words out. "I understand. I'll be happy to write as many glowing recommendations as you need. I'm sure you'll find a new position in no time." She wasn't lying about the recommendations. Angie was more of a cheery optimist than a malevolent presence. She would write those recommendations, those completely useless recommendations. "Thanks, Angie, I appreciate it. No point in saying anything else." Jeff stopped off at the Grillo-Rama on the way home, got two burgers with extra pickles and a vanilla shake, a feast fit for an unemployed librarian of a certain age. Carlotta texted at 6 a.m. He was already up, drinking coffee and reading the news. "I'll drive, okay, ETA 45 mins." He gave it a thumbs up, showered, and then decided he could go one more day without a shave. He fed the cats, after an unsuccessful few minutes of trying to get Bitsy and Snaggle to play with Birdie on a stick. His bag was already packed, camera and related equipment, sunscreen, bug spray, water bottle, rain jacket, spare mask, first aid kit. Also a little baggie with the game pieces from an old Monopoly set he'd found at a thrift store. Top hat, dog, battleship, race car, iron, horse and rider, howitzer. The people at the fire station loved anything to do with games. Playing cards, dice, game pieces, even those stupid fidget spinner toys that had been popular for a hot second. He was standing at the kitchen window, finishing his coffee and strapping on his watch, and staring out dumbly at the hideous McMansion that had been plunked down across the street from him the year before, interrupting his view to the river. She pulled up early again, more gold stars for Carlotta. He grabbed his bag, stuck a plain ball cap on his head, told the cats to be good, and jogged out to her car. The car was shiny and black and looked new. "Not the most inconspicuous vehicle," he said, getting in. "Also, good morning." "It's electric," she said. hand-me-down from my dad. She had never mentioned much about her family before. And it's probably a good thing. If anyone notices it, they'll think you're in the real estate business. So where to? Leadburg. But first to Halloran's, my regular spot to gas up before going exploring. You don't need gas, but I don't think we should break tradition. Indeed, we should not. So there they went. Halloran's store was on the Old Stage Road, which was called Old Stage Road. He got breath mints and a big coffee with milk and two Splendas and nodded a hello to Ronaldo behind the counter. Should we get some cookies or something like that to snack on, she asked. I'm not really big on cookies, he said, and it's not so far that we'll starve. We can get lunch at the barbecue place after. She was examining a spinner rack where plastic bags of candy dangled. She grabbed a bag of circus peanut candy and held it up. They still make this stuff. My grandmother loved this. She got a Coke to go with the bag of circus peanut candy, and then they hit the road in earnest. Jeff didn't need to navigate as they wound their way to Leadburg. She knew how to get there. More importantly, she knew how to get there via a route that prioritized old state and U.S. highways, no bypasses, no interstates. So I got laid off yesterday, he said, as they passed a crossroads where a sign read, Tick Bite, Unincorporated. She checked the mirrors and pulled off onto the shoulder, a few yards of grass on the edge of a piney forest. She turned to face him. Oh man, that sucks, Jeff. You got a plan of action, a next move? Not really. Collect unemployment, is that a plan? Might be time to sell the house. Property values are crazy now. Everything is. You're not really supposed to use the word crazy anymore like that. Put it this way, the world is broken. Yeah, but where'd you go if you sold your house? I tell you what, I could talk to my boss. You work at a nonprofit. I thought it was all environmental shit. You know, don't use bleach, plant wildflowers, all that. It is a little more complicated than that, but yes, you're right about bleach and wildflowers. Anyway, my boss has contacts at the library at the State University. I'm sure they need a digital media person. Jeff knew the State University librarians fairly well, and he knew that there were probably no job openings there. He kept this to himself. Thanks. She pulled back onto the road and accelerated. Seriously, that really sucks. Once they got to town, he gave directions. Someday, I just want to stumble onto an abandoned place, she said, while they were sitting at a stoplight. I don't want to be told where one is. I want to find one by accident. It'll happen, but not today. The light turned green and she started accelerating. From over a rise on the left came a giant white pickup truck barreling along and running the red light without stopping or slowing. She slammed on the brakes just in time to avoid a collision, then laid on the horn and didn't stop. It didn't matter because the white pickup was long gone. The momentum had sent him hard into the shoulder belt. Fuck, he shouted, one harsh syllable bouncing around the cabin. That's what I'm talking about, this world. No one gives a shit. Not enough of us running red lights, driving like a maniac in his climate change denial machine, probably has multiple guns in there, and not one damn mask. Fuck! I hear you, she said, and then kept going through the intersection. The old Leadburg fire station was on the far side of town on a lonely stretch of road across from the town cemetery. A car was stopped in their lane, and two shirtless men were standing behind it with their trunk open. They did not seem to notice or care that Carlotta was rolling up on them in her shiny black car. What do you reckon that is? She asked. Car trouble? Drug deal? I don't know. Probably just go around. She crossed the double yellow line and sailed around the men in their car. The fire station was just up the road. Jeff never liked to park too close to the sites he explored, but in this case there wasn't much of an option. The fire station was a boxy white layer cake of a building, art moderne by way of the Works Progress Administration. Brick with a stucco facade, three bays across and two stories high. The second story had a narrow inset balcony running across the front, accessible from a set of white French doors in the center. At the top of the facade, Leadburg Fire Dept, in a geometric stencil font, green letters against the white. Carlotta pulled in onto the cracked asphalt drive and parked around back. The rearmost part of the building was the drill tower, which extended a further three stories above the roof. At the base of the tower, there was a mottled green metal door, a boarded up window, and a no trespassing sign. The back door had a padlocked hasp. How do we get in? Well, you've heard my policy about breaking in while exploring, which is you don't. We don't. We find gaps in fences, we look for unlocked doors and windows, we sneak in through the woods, but we never permanently break anything to get into a place. Right. Never. "Which means it's good that I've got this key," he said, holding up a key that dangled from a red string around his neck. What they saw inside. Sunlight streaming in through the grids of glass block on either side, everywhere the peeling green and white paint on the walls and on the concrete pillars. A rusted central stairway, two circular holes in the ceiling on either side of the stairway where the fire poles used to be. In a back corner, a circle of mushrooms growing in a moldering rug that was lying in a puddle. Off to the side, a pile of wood scraps and conduit, which seemed to be in the process of devouring an old wooden desk with no drawers, the veneer curling away on top. Everywhere on the floor, oil stains. More prominently, toward the front, a pile of rubble from where a huge section of the floor above had completely given way. Even more prominently, next to that, a fire engine. "This is cool. Probably not as cool as that Masonic lodge you posted last month." "That right there is a 1968 Ford 850. And just wait, it gets cooler." They got their cameras out because that's what real explorers did. They went places and took photographs. He snapped a few more wide-angle shots with the digital Nikon he kept meaning to replace, taking care to keep her out of the frame. Nothing he hadn't shot before. She was carefully documenting the oil stains on the floor. He was a craftsman, but she was an artist. Outside, every few minutes a car would zip by on the road. They were mostly silent as they worked. And then, "Wow, this is some stain," she said. She was standing near the pile of rubble. "It's almost like someone dropped a bag of blood here." "You're right. It is almost exactly like that," he said. "Come on, let's go upstairs." Upstairs was darker. No glass blocks, just boarded up windows, but enough cracks and gaps to let in some light. A stack of plywood with an inverted foam cup on top. A trench coat hanging on a hook on the wall. An old American flag on a staff leaning in the corner. She went over to admire the flag. "I've seen your photo of this. It's great," she said. "Really saturated colors." "Yeah, kind of surprising that it's in such good shape for a 48-star flag." "Old. Older than me, yeah," he said. "And hey, careful of those holes. They took the fire poles out when they decommissioned this place." "Attractive nuisances. I sure would have tried one." She found more stains to photograph. They made their way to the front of the building. Before the massive wound in the floor, there was a line of objects on the perimeter, a boundary. Beyond the gap, the now useless French doors. "Don't go past those," he said. The line was made of these things. Keys, bottle caps, dice, plastic, army men that had fallen over, at least one playing card, the Six of Hearts, at least one tarot card, the Seven of Swords, an origami creature that might have been a horse or a dog, an oyster shell, a round red cat eye bicycle reflector. Unlike most every other thing in the building, these objects were not covered in dust. "Remember the balcony on the front? First time I came here, I really wanted to check that out." "How'd you get across?" "I didn't. That hole right there," he said, snapping another photo of the gap just for the hell of it. "That's where I fell through." "There's always a risk, right? Dumb stuff like getting poison ivy or chiggers. 1,000 ways to get a puncture or a cut. And yeah, when I used to go out by myself, I always thought, this could be how it ends. I was up in the control room of an old theater in Virginia one time. The floor had already mostly crumbled, but the joists were still there, so I walked across those because I really, desperately needed to take photos of the old carbon arc spotlight that was still bolted in place. This is how it ends, Jeff. You lying twisted on the floor. Maybe a concussion or a shattered ankle, trapped, no cell signal, even if you were conscious, the end. No one finds you until decades later. Like I literally had this mental image of just eventually being a skeleton on the floor of the theater. But I made it across. You've probably seen those spotlight photos. It was a Super Trooper, really cool piece of equipment. And I always made it across, getting nothing more than just the scratches and bug bites and rashes that you get if you were really end up hiking or something. And then one day I didn't make it across. Here. So this is the tricky part of the story. Perhaps you will be tempted to say something like, okay, boomer, after I tell you this. I was probably in shock, so I don't really remember much of this part, but I do have this image of lying there, bent backward, bleeding in impossible pain, looking up at that hole in the floor or in the ceiling, depending on your perspective, and I was thinking, this is it. This is how it ends. When I came to, I was repaired. I was in another place, lying on a banquet table on top of a hill where it looked like there'd been a forest fire quite recently.
The people who had fixed me were there. They were having a party. They're always having parties. I tried to get them to explain to me what had happened, who they were, where I was. They are not real big on explanations. So what I'm telling you is that there's another place that's connected with this building, and I go there sometimes. There are people there who aren't like us. I know how this sounds. Humor me. Consider yourself humored, she said. The doors on the fire engine read Leadburg Fire Department engine number 1. Jeff sat in the passenger seat, Carlotta in the driver's. I don't know if this will work. I've only gone alone before. Aren't you going to recite some rules first? Don't eat their food. Don't touch them with metal. Be extremely polite. What? I've eaten their food, and they love metal stuff. And why wouldn't I be polite to them? They saved my life. They're just fucking weird is all. Oh, and there's no photography. Your cameras won't be there. Your phone won't be there. True statements all, I'm sure. How does this go? Are we driving this thing into another dimension? No. What I do is I close my eyes. First, I think of the color red. All the possible reds. Tomatoes and rust and roses and fire engines. Yes, fire engines. And blood. Then I think about fire, and inside that fire, I build a bright red ladder, like day-glow red, and I think about climbing up that ladder out of the fire, up and up, and then there I go. To the other people? Not quite. There are stages. First, we go to the empty place. He waited as she closed her eyes. A minute passed, and then Carlotta glowed red herself and gasped, and then pop! She was no longer in the cab of the fire engine. He followed suit, completing his standard ritual. Climbing the ladder in his mind seemed to take much longer than usual, probably them fooling around. And then he was there. The empty place was a long tunnel. Black brick walls and floor, flickering gas lamps hung at intervals, providing a dim light. He materialized next to her. Holy shit! Holy fucking shit! She was saying and continued saying. But she was looking around, sizing the place up. It wasn't directed at him. I get it, it's a lot. Holy fucking shit, this is the weirdest thing that's ever happened to me! I would hope so. But it gets weirder if we walk that way. He pointed to the other end of the tunnel, maybe 100 feet away, which looked identical to the featureless dead end where they were standing. Exploring, he noted. Exploring, she agreed, catching her breath. Above them, there was no visible ceiling, just darkness. They walked to the other end of the tunnel. Just past the last gas lamp on the left, there was an opening, a deeper black in the dimness. He led the way. Just reach out and touch the wall if you need a guide. He walked ahead slowly. He could hear her breathing behind him, and then a gasp when they hit another left turn, and then an immediate jog back to the right through an archway, and there they were in the other place. The light was blinding. Once his eyes adjusted, he saw that today it was a bone-white beach on a spit of land. The banquet table and chairs were there, already sinking in the sand at the tide line. The tide was coming in. They were dressed up as they always were. Half seemed to look like they were in the French Navy, and the other half looked like they were working the sideshow at a Depression-era carnival. Ahoy, said one of the sailors, who then produced a bosun's pipe and proceeded to play a long and elaborate call that reminded him of a bird that used to nest right next to his mailbox. He mostly couldn't tell them apart because they all looked just about exactly the same. Maybe she'd have better luck. Blonde hair, skin as white as paper, bright red lips, cartoonishly long eyelashes. Really quite human in appearance, except that the cartoonishly long eyelashes framed eyes that were completely black, reflecting nothing at all, twin voids where human eyes would have been. Today, they were all wearing false mustaches and beards as well. Step right up, said one of the carnies, gesturing toward two empty chairs at the table. The table was heaped with stuff, tiered trays of seafood, wooden boxes of all sizes, empty candelabra, and a large rock that looked like a skull. They trudged through the sand and took their seats on either side of the one at the end of the table, who wore an elaborate uniform complete with bicorn hat and dangly gold earrings.
It was Bimbo Splint, the one Jeff always thought of as the captain, no matter what they were wearing. They always had on the dangly gold earrings when none of the rest of them ever did. Or maybe all of them just passed around the one pair of earrings and none of them were really the captain, the one called Bimbo Splint. That was entirely possible. Jeff checked in with Carlotta, who was still taking everything in, examining it all, the people, the table, the beach, the horizon. Out in the sea, there was a rocky outcropping, on top of which there was a lone tree, which was on fire. Jeff and the captain touched the backs of their hands together and nodded. "Welcome," said the captain, who extended the back of a hand to Carlotta. "Welcome to the everlasting now, the eternal present beyond the gap. Stay as long as you like. My name is Bimbo Splint." Bimbo waited, eyebrows raised, chin cocked toward Carlotta. "It's fine," Jeff said. "They know that my name is Jeff Jeffries, and so far they haven't tried to use my credit cards or steal my mail." "Carlotta Rodriguez," she said, touching the back of the captain's hand with her own, as Jeff had done. "Charmed," the captain replied. The captain peeled off the false mustache they were wearing. Beneath it was another, smaller mustache. Thank you.
I definitely want to see it.
Okay.
Sounds good to hear.
Thank you. Are there any more books left, Moses?
Yeah, I got one.
There's still some more books, so buy a couple. And have another drink, and I'll see you next month.
Yeah.
You have been listening to the Fantastic Fiction at KGB Reading Series. Check out our website at kgbfantasticfiction.org and click on support if you'd like to help keep the series going. Anyway, that's our show. Thanks for listening and see you next month.